dietary fats.
Dietary fats. I know it's such an interesting topic. I like talking about it because I think it's one of those things that everybody's a little bit confused on, right? So I think what you hear in, I guess I would say the media, right? Or I don't know exactly what I would necessarily call where you hear it from. But pretty much everywhere you always hear about carbohydrate manipulation, right? So whether you're going to increase carbohydrates, decrease carbohydrates, limit it to some capacity, right? Load to some capacity, whatever it's going to be, whether that be bodybuilding, weight loss, sports performance, that's kind of always what you hear. But there's really not a lot of talk about dietary fats unless you have people that are saying things about dietary fats in relation to, let's say, like hormone production, right? Or hormone control, or I guess healthy endocrine systems. But then even, or at that point, once we get there, I think that conversation also stops, right? Where it's like, yeah, you need to have or good fats for healthy testosterone production and healthy or just endocrines or endocrine functionality. And okay, go. Yeah. Right. And we kind of just, stop there, but we don't really talk about what's low, what's high, what types you should have, and honestly, where to go from there. And then how you should include that into the kind of big pie chart of your total energy consumption. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so I guess I would start by asking you, let's say, is there a particular thing that you do or strategy that you, how do you operate or control your fat intake? And then what types of fats are you typically eating, recommending, things like that?
Yeah, so obviously it's going to change different times of year for me personally, but sure. During prep, my saturated fat intake, if we're looking at specific types of fats that I'm consuming, very low, right? Now it's a little bit higher. I still like to keep that pretty moderate, low to moderate range.
How do you track, or do you track just by grams, or do you kind of just intentionally consume lower fat foods?
So I do track, but obviously I'm targeting, I'm putting almond butter in my oatmeal, you know,
and the butter in my coffee, baby.
And then regular butter in my coffee to have balance in the universe, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, just targeting the stuff you always hear about where you're getting these healthy fats from. So I'm getting the poly mono, from all my nut butters and things like that is usually where I target, just because I think they're really tasty and nice and satiating. They mix well with most things that I'm making. And then I track those on my app, my food tracking app, which I just downloaded the new, just downloaded.
Are you doing the Trexler one now?
Yes, I am. Have you tried it?
No, I have not, man. I've been a little bit, consumed with a few other things right now, but I did see it and I have my GA working on it right now as far as like checking it out to see if it would be useful or at least worth some kind of research, maybe an undergrad project, something like that.
I think so. So I think they did a really good job. I actually reached out to both of them giving my little bit of my feedback on it. I think they did a really good job. They put a lot of hard work into it. So yeah. I think it's based on whatever on the algorithms that they used, it can be a little difficult to make the program that it spits out for you, and because it individualizes like goals and everything for you for your macros. And so I think if you are like a bodybuilder looking to be like excessively high protein, you know, I think a lot of times it kind of undershoots on the protein. Sure. Everything else is like really good, in line, but, I think it kind of undershoots on the protein a little bit when you're looking at a bodybuilding population. But it usually Gen Pop or any other, performance sports or things like that, I think it would do a very, does a very good job.
As long as it's user friendly and it does it or
attractive. Yeah, and the interface is great.
Yeah. And so if that's good, that's typically what I would recommend for most people anyway. That's why I do usually promote MyFitnessPal, just because the interface
yeah.
and its applicability is so high. and it just gives somebody some sort of like objective data that they can use. So I was just curious about kind of how you were tracking those things. I think that's one thing that we typically don't do either is track very well. And plus we also have the issue with the differences in energy densities from carbohydrates and fats. And that can kind of really look or distort your perception of how much you're actually eating as well as it comes to dietary fats. So obviously we know that the dietary fats have 9 calories per gram, right? And so your carbohydrates have 4 calories per gram. And so even though you see, or typically what happens is you'll see somebody that'll look at their fat grams and it's relatively low grams, right? So if you see something like 15 to 20 grams, right? Compared to like the 40 grams of carbohydrates, the 40 grams scares you.
Right.
Right. But then the 20 grams or the 18 grams, typically 20 starts to get a little scary, I think, from a fat grams perspective. But people look at 17, right? 16 grams of fat and be like, yeah, right. No big deal. But then over time, obviously it adds up. But I think there's some misrepresentation. That's probably not a good word, but it kind of a distorted perception of your actual energy density between those.
Right.
So if you're not tracking it, you can get a lot or a high fat diet really quickly.
It's so easy. It's really so easy.
And that's one of my other really big things too, is, you know, you've probably heard it quite a bit, is whenever you have people that are trying to diet or asking for dietary information just to in any capacity, or you'll have people who are maybe not, I wouldn't say nutritionally illiterate, but maybe a little bit less informed as far as nutrition goes, would be saying that they're going to carb up with their pizza.
That's not a carb up.
Yeah. Right. And
there's so I just as much, if not more fat. Oh,
they'll look at pizza or they'll talk about things like donuts and all these things. And of course there's probably about 50-50, right? Carbohydrates to fat, and they're from on an energy basis, right? So on a calorie, you know, on a calorie basis, not a grams basis for sure. But I hear that all the time. They're like, oh, I can't, it's just that I can't stop eating the carbs. It kills me. Like every time I see pizza, I have to eat it. I'm like, I don't think that it's the carbohydrates in there that's number one, killing you and satiating you, but that's also making you, let's say, fatter, so to speak, right? It's that there's a lot of fat in that, or that pizza.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the difference, right, that you see, is that there's really this kind of like misconstrued reality as far as what your food actually contains from a fat perspective. And that happens, Aaron, that's why one of my first recommendations for most people is to stop eating out. Eat whatever you want from your house.
Yep.
Right. And the reason that I say that is because it is so hard to quantify the amount of butter and oil and all the things that you're going to be eating in those kind of whatever food outlet that you want to discuss. But basically, they're using all these, there are lots of butters, lots of creams, because those are the really satiating foods that are going to help. Right. Give you that reward.
It tastes good.
The fat in there gives you the taste. It gives you the texture. It gives you the richness that you're going to get, or that's going to cause that reward to occur in the brain, or reach that reward threshold in the brain more so than something like carbohydrate will, which is why you like pizza. You're telling me you would like your pizza the same way if it was just bread with nothing else on it, or bread with some sauce.
Yep. It's all the cheese and the meat.
Right. It's cheese, or yeah, you have the cheese, you have the animal fats from the meats, the sausages, the bacons. Most of the time you're going to have some kind of oil that you use for it. Now it's not typically standard. It depends on how they're going to make the pizza, let's say. But the Alfredo sauce that you put on there, right? All of those things are going to contribute to that reward that you get from eating such high fat foods, but because it's on a big piece of bread, right? People typically look at the pizza and say it's a really high carbohydrate meal, when in reality it's really not. And so it's really important to kind of consider the fact that most of those foods that you're eating out are not that high in carbohydrate. Where you get the carbohydrates from, let's say if you eat out, is going to be from things like your sodas, right, that you would have. So if you have like your big gulp sodas, or wherever you're going to get some of your big fatty foods at, so your fattening meals, right? You get those carbohydrates typically from doing stuff like the drinks. Not that the rest of the meal doesn't have carbohydrates, but for sure is containing much more fat than you would think. So again, kind of full circle back, that's why I typically recommend eat from your house, because you can control what's going in there. And you use much less butter, much less oil, because at least you're, let's say, aware of what's going in and how much you actually need. And you can at least shallow fry things. Whereas somewhere else is going to just dip that bad boy all the way in.
Oh yeah. There's
so and then weird. Not put it on and then not put it on the paper towel. Mm-hmm. Right. So that you can get a little bit of the extra off. That's going right in the box. But that's kind of one thing with, as far as dietary fat goes, just like kind of a surface level type of thing, as far as a good strategy to help you get to a lower fat status and know how much you're intaking, because knowing how much you're intaking is like one of the biggest parts. Because you can go up to, you can say, yeah, I typically do a low fat diet or a, let's say a lower fat diet. But then if you actually analyze your intakes, all of a sudden you realize, oh shoot, I'm eating almost 40% of my diet from fat. Right. And I'm typically a bigger fat eater than I am a carbohydrate eater. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people would be, at least in Western culture.
That's if you think about all the food you're grabbing for busy people, you're going to grab like through a drive through or something, it's fat laden, right? So it makes sense.
Yeah, no. And I generally enjoy foods that are going to be a little bit higher in fats as well, rather than foods that are a little bit more or higher in carbohydrates. It's just kind of what I enjoy. Mm-hmm. And so that goes back into a lot of things. Maybe we talked about it before in a previous podcast about kind of working or your diet with alongside your nature.
Right.
Right. So we talk about, you know, differences in macronutrients not necessarily mattering too much over the long period, as long as you're controlling energy and protein. Mm-hmm. You really want to focus on your nature. I know after I've analyzed my diet that I eat a little bit more fat than I probably should. But as long as my calories and my protein are sufficient, right, then as long as my fats aren't like coming from incredibly bad sources over a long period of time, then I should be just fine. And my exercise.
So if once we get protein set, calories are equated, what should I really be targeting and what should I really be avoiding for my fat intake? Because I hear a lot about, you know, I kind of know the answer to this question already, but I want people to know. You hear a lot about like avoid, this is a big one you hear, avoid red meats because of their saturated fat content and things like that. What can you tell me about that?
So it really depends on a few things. So I actually talked about this in my class the other day. So when we look at just overall, like big picture, we'll get down to the details in just a second. Think about a big picture. We look at obesity, right? Over since 1975, which is kind of when we started tracking these things. So we take obesity, and obviously it's been going this way. It doesn't take a genius to know, right, that we're going in that upward direction. Well, interestingly, right, what's happened with red meat? Very small uptick, about 3-4% are increase. So obviously those things are not related, right? We're not seeing too much of a change in red meat consumption, right? But we're seeing an increase in obesity. You know, we are seeing an increase in, as far as the meat goes, like almost more than ever before, chicken and poultry, or just poultry, basically. So you would see obesity and chicken, and then red meat going all the way across in that linear, or just kind of direction this way, or horizontal direction, excuse me. And so there doesn't seem to be an association there, right? So whenever people say things like red meat consumption is, let's say, bad and you shouldn't do it, we're definitely not talking about it being bad as far as weight gain or weight loss. That we know for a fact, right? So where people are going to typically consider the red meats unhealthy, or at least where you would try to justify red meats being unhealthy, would be in how it affects you as in the cardiovascular system, mm-hmm. right? So how it's going to affect your blood lipids and your kind of systemic cholesterol there. And most people have already kind of led into the answer. We used to think that the cholesterol that you would get from your red meats would contribute to your cholesterol, right? Or your circulating cholesterol. And that's not the case. And we know that too. Same thing with eggs, right? So there was like the What the Health documentary, and there was that big thing on What the Health that everybody kind of laughed at. Well, not everybody, because people believed it, but most of knowledgeable people would laugh at it when they made the statement of five eggs was equal to smoking like one cigarette or something like that. or one egg was equal to smoking five cigarettes. That's what it was, the inverse, I believe. Now, I may end up having to correct myself, but that's what the statistics said. And it came from a study that was really, really flawed. Man, I don't blame a lot of studies for the things that they do. They make their decisions, and it's our job to interpret them the right way, right? So that we're not being misinformed. And so they just happen to choose as their high fat, you know, meal, let's say, eggs. And then they found the correlation between like this one kind of highly or high fat kind of, or, you know, food product was associated, right, with the same health risks that you would get from smoking a cigarette. Now, there were a lot of things that went into that as far as these people were already in like a cardiac ward, right? They were already older. They're all of their BMIs were obese, right? So there were a lot of things that were actually contributing to it, not necessarily the fact they were consuming eggs. We've kind of done that with red meats as well, right? Where we take a really unhealthy population whose obesity is going up this way, right? Because their obesity is going up this way, cardiovascular disease is going to be happening in that same direction, or as going to follow that same trajectory, right? That's kind of been red meats kind of up till recently, so to speak, as far as cardiovascular disease and obesity. But we know now that that's not really the case. What's really going on, right, is going to be, of course, lack of physical activity, which is going to decrease energy output, right? And just overall or overconsumption of food that's making you obese and putting stress on the arteries, right? Making them lose kind of that elastic property. All those things are occurring because of the weight gain, which is not necessarily related to the red meat consumption, or at least the cholesterol in there, let's say.
Makes sense. You do hear a lot about the contribution of red meat and this cholesterol intake to your overall cholesterol. So I think that's a good, good for people to know that that's more of a misnomer.
Yeah, for sure. And now you would still want to recommend that the saturated fat intake is low, mm-hmm. right? So you'd obviously want your saturated fat intake to be or less than 10% of your total energy consumption. And so that ends up being like 13 to 15 grams, like a normal 2000 calorie diet or so.
Right.
But obviously if you're eating more than 2000 calories per day, let's say you're a bodybuilder and you need to be eating quite a bit more than that. Let's say you need 3000 plus. Well, then that gives you a little bit more room in there. And then at that point, you want to quit, or at that point, once you're consuming that many grams of saturated fat, you really want to start questioning your diet itself. Is that those saturated fat calories that you're getting are probably not coming from you just eating red meat every day or eating red meat for every meal, right? Which I would assume that most people are not eating red meat for every meal, especially if you're a bodybuilder, right? Because you have to eat a lot of food, right? Yeah, you have to eat a lot of food. And you can't always afford the red meat. The red meat can sometimes be a luxury based on how much food you actually have to eat.
Oh yeah. The red meat, it might be you save that for dinner maybe, or a couple times, maybe just a few times a week.
And you're not netting after the cooking process, and not that they're, you know, that you're cooking a ton of it out anyways, but you're not netting that many grams of saturated fat per, let's say, normal serving, like a 3.5 ounce serving of red meat, mm-hmm. which is kind of your standard serving. You're really not. And so for you, or if you're eating a 3000 calorie diet, you're not really getting to that saturated fat level off just red meat alone. Right. And the cholesterol is really not impacting you that way. Right. Because that's not how food and cholesterol work together. The cholesterol in your food isn't what's going to affect your kind of circulating cholesterol. And it's not the saturated fat in the red meat that's making you fatter. So really what happens is we come down to, okay, what is it that's actually making you fat, and why are you eating so many grams of fat that are saturated, which are the type ones that you probably shouldn't be eating, let's say? Well, it's probably because you're eating a bag of potato chips, right? 17 potato chips is what, 17 grams of fat or something like that. You're slamming a party size bag of barbecue Lays, and then you're wondering why your cholesterol is really high. Well, and then what happens is you don't think about the Lays, or you'll be eating something like a pizza, right? Let's say. And you're also eating steak a lot too, but because you're presuming that the chips and the pizza are high carbohydrate meals, then you're going to blame it on the red meat intake, if that makes sense.
Right.
Right. Whenever you were in reality, if you were to actually take or analyze your diet the other way, you'd see, oh shoot, I'm actually getting a lot of fat, not necessarily from the steak. I'm getting it a lot from the chips and the pizza that I'm eating and I'm slamming every weekend, right? And so, you know, I would never recommend, say, hey, you should just start consuming a ton of saturated fat, right? Because there is some data to suggest, right, that it is bad for your cardiovascular system. You should be eating better sources of dietary fat. But I'm also not going to be the first person to say that that's what's causing all these issues.
Right. So it sounds like my weight gain issues aren't associated with specifically my saturated fat intake, but my overall caloric intake, huh?
So it'd be, yeah, overall caloric intake. I don't know if it's probably not fair. So this is a good question, actually, because we really need to identify the difference between total fat intake and then the differences between our degrees of saturation of our fat. So that's where degrees of saturation is how saturated your fats are with hydrogens. Mm-hmm. And so your saturated fatty acids are really saturated with hydrogens. Mono or not, mono have the one double bond that basically desaturate, right, the hydrogen. And then you go down the chain right into poly, polyunsaturated fatty acids. Now, even polyunsaturated fatty acids are pro-inflammatory as well. So you can actually have too great an intake of fatty acids. Those are precursors to some of the, so you're not supposed to consume too many of those either, right? You should really be focusing on things like your omega-3 fatty acids. But all that to say, total fat intake should be separated, right, from the different biological functions of your different levels of saturation, your dietary fats. So saturated fatty acids have different biological functions than mono. Mono differ than poly. They all have their unique capabilities in the body, right? Which is why if you were to consume high MUFA, unsaturated fatty acids, let's call it MUFAs for now because it's fun. If you were to consume more MUFAs, right, what you're going to see there, right, different than what you're going to see in consuming a high saturated fatty acid meal or a high polyunsaturated, specifically polyunsaturated with omega-6 fatty acid, you're going to see increased HDL, right, or cholesterol, which is really good, let's say. Whereas we've actually seen in multiple studies, and we have some preliminary data from the keto study that we did and some other data from some previous studies in healthy females, to say that those ketogenic diets that are high in saturated fatty acids, because it's hard to get a lot of fat from really healthy sources all the time, you're going to see the increase in LDL cholesterol if you're healthy and not losing weight, right? And so they all have their little different functions in the body, right? And so it's important to separate those out from total fat intake is kind of my point there. But then overall, no, the fat's not really contributing to your weight gain or weight loss. Now, what I'm interested in from your perspective, and there, like I said, that's a whole lecture right there that we could go into, is how do you see fat fitting into body composition changes? Because to me, other than, you know, your caloric, you know, your overall caloric intake, what do you prescribe? And maybe what do your clients kind of give you the feedback as far as like, do they find it hard to not consume fats? Do you have a specific recommended amount that you have them on? Kind of just what are you hearing and what are you doing?
Right. So just purely looking at body compositional changes, that's what I do, you know, body composition. At the end of the day, that's what I'm coaching people to do. That's what I'm doing myself. Right. I generally, when I'm looking to, let's say, start trimming up, getting ready for prep, or even on prep, right? My fat intake usually sees the biggest drop of any of the macros. Protein still usually just as high, maybe just under what it would normally be during a maintenance phase, you know?
Sure.
Carbohydrates obviously are coming down as well. Those drop as well. But fat comes down a good bit. And it's usually because of the nutrient density of fat, right? The energy density. You talked about earlier, it has nine calories per gram, whereas protein and carbs are four. So that the fat on prep, this past prep, I was usually topping out most of the time between 40 to 45 grams of fat per day.
Gotcha.
Coming, dropping down from the 90 to 100, I am in a bulking phase, sometimes more on some days where I really indulge myself. That's usually what takes the biggest drop percentage wise, you know, from between, you know, the maintenance phase, the bulking phase, the weight loss phase, because of the energy density, right? So my total calories are coming down when I'm dropping these grams of fat down. Because what I'm focused on is being in a caloric deficit. And since fat has the high caloric density, that's what I have to focus on to really drop down. Secondarily, things that I'm consuming that are high in fat usually have some decent carb components on them as well, right? Which I'm also limiting during deep into prep, right? Not so much early on. And I don't want to start making anybody here start limiting their carbs because that's good for weight loss or whatever, because it's not necessarily. So it's more of a nuanced answer, right? So fat is the first one that really takes a big hit from the nutrient density standpoint. And then the satiation standpoint, because the water fats, they're super tasty, right? So when I eat something that's high in these fats, it's usually something that tastes good, right? Something chocolatey or super savory, right? And now once I've had a bite of something like that, my inhibition to say no, or my ability to say no, right? My inhibition capacity, gone, right? It's now easier for me to say, what's one more bite? Yeah. Okay, what's one more bite?
That one more bite, yeah.
What's one more bite? And then, I've demolished a whole tub, a whole pint of Blue Bell.
Yep.
Great. You know, so there's really kind of three factors that play into me limiting fats with myself and clients going into a weight loss phase. They do rebound up, obviously, during bulking. I do find it sometimes difficult. The clients find it difficult to reduce fats to a certain degree, especially those that are really trying to drop some weight, because it's easy to consume them. Things are everywhere. Especially those new individuals who are fresh to tracking. I don't think they realize how much fat is in certain items, right? Until they see it in their app. They're like, good Lord.
I think a big issue I don't think that people really understand. Same with me, you know, I kind of thought myself a while ago that I was more of a carbohydrate eater. Than I was a dietary fat eater. I all of a sudden look at my charts. I'm like, oh shoot, that is actually the exact opposite. I'm about 50-50, and then even more so, right? Or outside of protein, let's say. But I don't think that people really understand how much fat they're actually consuming. And so because you don't know how much fat you're actually consuming, because it's a little bit harder to track. I would agree that it's a little bit harder to track than other macronutrients in general, because you don't really know what's going into certain things. Especially if you're eating out, but even if you're not, let's say it's a little bit easy to get carried away. And so if you're eating a lot of fat all the time, you're unaware of how much fat you're actually eating. Well, somebody, just like anything else, tries to take it away from you. Not only are you taking away something that person normally consumes, right, whenever they're hungry, so you're going to cause that craving, but you're taking away one of the most satiating and tasty texturous, I don't know what the word would be for that, right? Something with a lot of texture, you're taking all of that away from the individual. And so it's going to be extremely hard to do it. And so that actually happens quite a bit with just basic caloric restriction, right? So this is also goes back into why sometimes your higher fat diets will work, right? At least in the short to kind of moderate or medium duration, right? Because you're eating a lot of fat. So it's really satiating. It doesn't take a lot of fat to make you feel full. What you have to fight there is the reward threshold, but you definitely are going to get full. You're going to have that stomach distension. You're going to have your physiological signals of satiety, right? That's going to limit your hunger response. So that's why things like the ketogenic diet, people would say that they were feeling more full in the ketogenic diet because they're eating a lot of protein, they're eating a lot of fat. There's some discussion on whether or not your ketones are going to contribute to that. But again, let's keep that out for a different discussion. Now on the flip side of that, whenever you take away the dietary fats, kind of the exact opposite happens, right? Is you're going to take away the things that are really satiating. You're going to take away the things that people are normally eating. Those cravings are going to increase, and it can be really hard. Now that eventually happens with the ketogenic diet as well with carbohydrates, right? And so that's kind of why whenever you look at all these or look at these studies that do some sort of like high level or macro, not high level, but some significant macronutrient restriction, specifically carbohydrates or fat, they all tend to even out over like a longer duration period, as long as calories and protein are being controlled. Now, whenever you talk about doing like a lower fat diet, which again, I would typically recommend myself, or at least do some kind of moderate fat intake, but nowhere close to doing like the higher fat. I would say probably about 30% to 28% would be about right. Right. And that's about what most people will consume. And so let me get back into kind of what the studies will show, which would be that whenever you eliminate the fat in the in the long term, you have what they call, you're blending in with the world.
Oh, yes.
you have what they call learned compensation, or you start to compensate, right? Meaning that when you start consuming meals that are lower in fat, you don't have that same satiety response. You don't feel satiated, you don't feel full. And so you compensate for those things at later meals. And that happens over time, right? And so things will kind of even out. You also have those satiety-specific responses that are contributing to that kind of all in one thing is you're compensating because you don't feel full, or you don't feel like you've, you're compensating because you're not eating enough energy. Compensating because you're not eating enough energy because you eliminated the fats, which are high energy density, 9 calories versus 4 with carbohydrates. And then you're going to compensate further because you're not being satiated, right? So all of these things are contributing to eventually you're going to go back to eating more fat, right? Or eating more food in general, mm-hmm. which may be in the form of carbohydrates, AKA getting right back to consuming the same amount of energy just through carbohydrates instead of fat,
right?
Or going backwards and consuming more fat. So they all tend to really even out.
Right.
Right.
For the fat debt.
Yes. Yes. So you go into a nice old fat debt. But, and what you see in the literature as well is that even whenever you run these long-term studies, let's say you put somebody on a diet that's 20% from fat, mm-hmm. right? Now, that's not very much, right? 20% of their energy from fat would be would be very, very little, right? What ends up happening is that you see people not have that much success over a higher fat diet or a normal fat diet, because just like you would have seen like with with the protein consumption in our keto study, it's actually really hard to get that low of fat, mm-hmm. right? Especially in the Western cultures.
Yeah.
Basically, you really have to basically look at the back of your food labels and say, I will not eat anything with more than 3 grams of fat in it with the amount of food or per serving, let's say. And then if you do that, yeah, you can do it. But again, we're getting down into the nitty gritty where that's really hard to do. All of a sudden you eat one thing, you don't realize it. You're way over that intake for the day and you're back up to 28%. So to speak. But that's kind of what the average would be as far as like, I'm trying, but I can't get there. You end up being at about 26 to 28% instead of 20. And so it seems to be a comfortable place for people to restrict, but still get it in is about that 28%.
That's usually a good number. Yeah. Like you said, restricting any farther than that can be very difficult. I know this because on prep, like that's a lot of what's happening. You have to be very, very cautious of what you're grabbing out of your pantry, out of your fridge. Like you said, finding things that contain under 3 grams of fat per serving, it's difficult to do. And so your choices are really limited. And so some people really struggle is because it's hard, right? It's not easy. And so I've seen people get really defeated with that fact. Over time, they've gotten better because you learn to get creative, right?
Yeah.
you figure it out.
Man, I'll tell you what, this is some interesting, and I think this is interesting just outside of a science realm and just like some of the strategies that I've tried before to kind of do that. Cause I actually really enjoy, I'll tell you what, if we just think about body composition and my own N of one, right? Yeah. My own perception, I loved the way I looked on the low fat diet.
Yeah.
Right. I looked great. I was still fueled for my workouts because I was consuming carbohydrates. Now it was hard because I almost did that strategy where I was like, okay, 4 or 5 grams of fat, if it has that per serving, that's my max. Anything more than that, And five was still pushing it sometimes for me. But the foods that have that are so limited. And so what I would do a lot of times is I would just honestly go to the candy aisle and the sweets aisle. You'd get some cereal, 1 gram of fat per serving. And that sometimes they're rounding up, mm-hmm. right, to get the 1 gram of fat. So I would just do cups of Fruity Pebbles with no milk.
Heck yeah.
Or just pretzels, right? Doing things like pretzels. Pretzels are a really good one for you to be able to have. And so if you get like the pretzel crisp that are the buffalo flavor or something, you get a little buffalo sprinkle.
Yep.
Right. So those are things that you can eat. You just have to be aware of it. And you can still eat things that are good. Or how about I would do, I'm a big pasta guy, mm-hmm. right? And so I could have I could always eat pasta. So of course you can do things like marinara with your pasta and chicken, but sometimes I would want some more of the creaminess to it. Well, they have like the fat-free Alfredo, mm-hmm. which is terrible or tasting, but you can take like if you put it in a pot, you can actually take like the Kraft Parmesan, like the grated one that you would just sprinkle, give it a little bit of extra cheese in there. It's like 1.5 grams of fat per 1/4 cup. Mm-hmm. Right. And you can put that in the Alfredo to make it a little bit better. Right. Put some, like, and their strategy, you're going to be, like you said, you have to be creative, but you can run those low fat strategies and eat well.
Of course, yeah.
Or how about this fat-free Greek yogurt? You can put that in your Alfredo.
That's a good way to do it.
And so there are things that you can do and to get you to that low fat status. And I have personally enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Even though I am more of a fat eater, how about this? I enjoyed my physique enough that I would follow it again. Right. But I think that goes back into other specific strategies. And so you had talked about doing like your nut butters, mm-hmm. right? Let's say somebody maybe they have a nut allergy, right? And they can't do those things. I guess what other types of dietary fats do you recommend? And what about things like fatty fish? Do you eat like fatty fishes? Or fish oils do you recommend? Kind of what are your thoughts on let's say MUFAs, what kind of things do you recommend there?
Yeah. So, I mean, if an individual has a nut allergy, right? Pretty common. The big target that I would turn to next would be things like my olive oil, like virgin olive oil, whenever I'm cooking with something, to add a little bit extra fats, because we need dietary fats, right? We know how important those are for our right. physiological functioning. With the fatty fishes, that is something that I definitely targeted on my even like in my low fat diets, like during prep. Salmon was in there for sure,
yeah.
right? It's got great fat content. Still relatively low. It's high for fish for protein, right? Plus, it tastes good. Salmon's great.
You know? I do love some salmon.
Salmon was good stuff.
Oh, it's so good.
So salmon definitely was something I was eating very regularly on prep. On those days, I did not take, when I knew I was eating salmon, because I had like my days planned out to a T on prep, you know, I knew exactly what I was eating when. I wouldn't take my fish oil in the morning, you know, but on days that I am consuming a fatty fish, or I wasn't consuming a fatty fish, sorry, I would take my fish oil in the morning.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I agree with pretty much everything. I always think about the almighty avocado, right? Mm. Which I do love avocado.
It didn't even cross my mind, because I hate avocado. So like,
yeah, I was gonna say, I do like me some avocado. Now I am conscious about, you know, it's our caloric density, right? And so that's kind of should be always the overarching theme, is like, yes, if you love avocado, you should probably try and fit avocado in there. Don't think about an avocado as the savior, right, for you, because you can overconsume an avocado just like you can overconsume everything else. Eventually, if you consume enough of the, or if you increase that total fat intake and the energy density that goes along with it, that's still just as bad for you. You're just doing it in, let's say, the less harmful way. Maybe I don't even know if that's true at that point.
I think, yeah.
But right, like, you know, there are things that you can do. You just have to, of course, be mindful mm-hmm. of your actual intake. But yeah, the things like avocados, if you like walnuts, you can do walnuts. Now, some of your nuts, like you said, if we're getting away from nuts is kind of the idea, but those can get really expensive and they're kind of raw form, right? And so the butters are a really good way to kind of start to include those things as well. And the or walnuts will give you some good sources of omegas as well. Now, as far as it goes with things like the fish, right, which fish are one of the only ways that you can get your EPA, DHA, which are going to be your omega-3s. And those are really, really important to make sure that you're getting. And if you're not getting them from omega-3 rich foods, you should be supplementing with them kind of to some capacity. Now, I will say just from the basic recommendations, you should get about 500 milligrams or 0.5 grams is the minimum kind of recommended amount you should be getting. Any fish oil supplement's going to get that for you. Right. So that's one thing that everybody I would definitely recommend that you do, because there's a lot of really good benefits to having that. The first thing is that you're going to increase your omega-3 index. And so we go back and look at the research, even in really highly trained athletes, when their omega-3 levels are really low, they are at risk for later on down the road, right? Cardiovascular risk. So some studies, and it's almost very similar to kind of the egg study, so I won't say that it's 100% true, but would put you having a low omega-3 status, right? Which is what they would get from your blood, omega-3 index, let's say. Omega-3 index that's low puts you at a similar risk of smoking from cardiovascular disease risk, right? Now, again, that's kind of an extreme example, but it kind of just goes along the lines of, hey, you should really be consuming your omega-3s. They're going to help you with your cardiovascular system, specifically your triglycerides, are decreased with omega-3 consumption. They're not going to have any like real benefit from a body composition perspective, so to speak, but they can decrease subjective soreness, right? Help you with a little bit of immune response as well. So that can help you with recovery. Now, I don't know to what extent, that's a little bit over my head. They also have some neuroprotective implications to them as well. And so highly recommend making sure you consume those. Now, here's where it gets a little bit more into the like, athlete, high-level exerciser, bodybuilder, things like that, is that it appears like something interesting happens with omega-3 fatty acids in your highly trained individuals who are exercising, right? Resistance training, high intensity, endurance training, whatever you want to call it, or whatever exercise form you're doing, it seems that you are metabolizing those to a greater extent. And so with the normal recommendation would be 5,000 or 500 or 0.5 grams, let's say, it's easier to work in the small numbers. Athletes like that should be consuming 2 to 4 grams per day, which is starting to get up there a little bit, right? As far as how much fish you would need to take, you almost need to eat fish and supplement together. And that's what most recommendations will say. But the good thing is that we actually just did a study. We just finished a study at TCU about this, is that in those types of athletes, you can improve your omega-3 index or in your omega-3 status overall in just 2 weeks, because not only do you metabolize it quicker, but you respond to supplementation and treatment much faster than a normal individual would. So you get all of those benefits within just a couple weeks. And at least 6 weeks, right, of just daily supplementation, and not even that consistent supplementation. So just a little bit can go a long way from supplementation and eating enough fish. And so I would recommend that 100% for athletes. But that, as far as those go, you know, those are the types of dietary fats that you would recommend. And if we're talking about cold water fish or fatty fish, the interesting thing is that it's always my fun fact, is that the fish aren't the things that have the omegas in them, right? It'd be the algae. And so the fish eat the algae, right? So you have fish that eat those algae to be able to, and it soaks in through the tissues of the fish. Those would be in sardines, tunas, what is it, mackerel. I don't know anybody that eats mackerel though.
You don't see that one a lot.
No. But for sure you would get it from the salmon, right? So salmon and tuna typically are the ones that you would see that in. So always trying to prioritize consuming those. And if you can find it for a good price, I think it should be part of your weekly nutrition plan, as you should be consuming fish and omega-3 supplements to some capacity. And then you can start to include some of those other things you'll get anyways. Like I would assume, what type of oil do you use specifically for your cooking, if you use it?
Yeah. So very rarely right now do I use much olive oil or anything like that, but it's usually like a virgin olive oil.
Yep. Yeah, I'm typically doing extra virgin olive oil, which is going to be great for monounsaturated, right? So actually, your highest monounsaturated fatty acid, if you actually look at it on the molecular form, it's called oleic acid, mm-hmm. which is very similar to olive oil. It's how I try and teach my kids how to identify those things, right? Olive oil, oleic acid, monounsaturated fatty acid. What type? Olive oil, oleic, right? It's just kind of a thing that I have them memorize there. But you actually get quite a bit of polyunsaturated fatty acids as well. And so kind of what ends up happening with those oils is that there's a distribution, right? So there's never really just like, oh, it's all a monounsaturated fat. So I would hesitate for people to say olive oil is a monounsaturated fatty acid. So the better language would be olive oil is rich in monounsaturated fatty acids, because you're still getting polyunsaturated fatty acids right. in them. Well, you're still going to get some saturated fatty acids in there. And that goes for all of your different fats, especially your oils, right? They're going to have it, or they're going to vary in how much they actually have from each thing. And so we kind of want to use that language. And then, I mean, it's as easy as just kind of looking it up as far as what's going to have what in there. Now, I don't remember off the top of my head some of your more, let's say, poly or monounsaturated fatty acid foods other than olive oil. But most things are going to kind of mix between the 40 to 60 range on your healthier fats, if that makes sense. So you might have something that's like 55 to mono, 45 poly, right? And we would consider it a monounsaturated fatty acid, but obviously it has other things in there as well. So I think it just takes, and I typically wouldn't trust somebody to Google anything on their own, right? But just a quick Google will go a long way as far as which foods have what in there.
Right. Yeah. All you have to do is just type in whatever saturated fat or fat breakdown, fat content breakdown. Boom. You've got it. You know.
Yeah.
So.
Sorry. Sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say. So like, yeah. I do mix up what kind of oils and stuff I'm using sometimes. I will say last weekend had me a great fish fry, and in the oil of choice was nice peanut oil, you know.
There you go. Okay.
For frying my fish, worked fantastic. Did I look up what my fat breakdown was for that? Absolutely not, because I was going to enjoy myself.
I don't want to know that sometimes. Now, how about this? Pulled up my little reference sheet for all my oils that I have. I have that on hand in my files.
Good, as you should.
I know I've done so many fat studies now. I hope that I would be better at this, but anyways, I had to take a second look because I couldn't remember the number on something. What's your thing? What do you think about coconut oil?
I think it probably gets
because it's so popular.
It probably gets a lot more hype than it should be getting. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So the hype is mostly it's a weird thing that we tend to do is we take something that we don't know much about, but because it comes from like a healthy source that you are perceived healthy source, right. We give it a healthy tag, mm-hmm. right? Without actually knowing what its actual composition is. And so if you were to guess the composition of a coconut oil and you would hear things like medium chain triglyceride. And when we hear things like medium chain triglyceride, which is what your coconut oil is, it sounds very moderate, right? It's like medium coconut. It really can't be that bad. Right. But really it is almost, it is probably about as high as saturated fat oil that you can possibly get. Right. And so that's why whenever a lot of the times you see your coconut oil, whenever it's liquid, it actually has to go through a different process to get it to be liquid. Right. Most of the time that coconut oil is going to be solid. Anytime you see a solid or fat, it's going to be mostly saturated fat, which is why things like butter stay solid at room temperature. Mm-hmm. Same thing with coconut oil. So if you look at, so what the actual breakdown of saturation is for coconut oil would be 86% saturated. Right. And so when you're throwing a bunch of coconut oil in the pan, right? Thinking that it's a good alternative to butter, you're doing yourself a big disservice.
Right.
Right. Because you're just consuming the same thing, but because it has coconut in there, right? we perceive it as healthy, but it's really not.
I think a lot of things get that tag because it comes from something in nature. You know, it's like, oh, this is healthy for me. And that goes for supplements, foods, a lot of stuff, you know. So I think it then becomes our responsibility to be a more informed consumer of products overall. Just that coconut oil example is just a big highlight of that point.
Yeah. And I mean, you get that. And so what they call it tropical oils. So not that anybody really uses it, but you can also, like, if you go to some of your health food stores, you'll actually find, now I'm going to forget what it's called. Palm oil is another big one. It's like red, right? And you can use that in some of your baking things, but that's another one that's right along there with coconut oil. So these tropical fruits, right? These tropical oils are actually very saturated, but you're hearing kind of tropical and fruit and all these things. And you have this kind of misperception of it when really you should just kind of stick to the guns, right? Which would be all of your nut oils. So like your peanut oils, if you're really high in monounsaturated fatty acid, it's also going to be relatively good for polyunsaturated fatty acid. And you want to pick those that you kind of know are healthy, right? So things like your avocado oils, a little bit better fat content. You're going to have your canola oils. I'm actually a canola oil person.
That's another one that I see a lot for. Especially when I'm a big fish fry guy. So, yes. You know, when I come across one of those, a canola oil is another one that shows up a lot.
I do the canola oils. Again, this is mostly going back into sticking with a good fat. So I like olive oil. I typically would use olive oil almost in a raw form, as far as like not using it to cook. So I would use it for like a dressing potentially. If I was going to use one, now I typically am not a huge olive oil dressing type of person either, because I don't believe that it's easy to control that.
Right.
Whenever you need to, I like my salad drenched, right? And things, right? So I'll just get the light Olive Garden Italian.
Oh yes. That and like a light vinaigrette are like that, my two favorites.
Yes. So I'll do that. But olive oil, it has some utility there, and you can obviously cook with it, and it's a really good option. I picked the canola oil because it actually has a lower cooking temperature. And so it'll give me the fried texture, right? A little bit better than something like the olive oil would, so to speak. So if I do quite a bit of sweet potato. And so I like to have like a sweet potato almost mimic my real potatoes as far as like getting the nice outer crust. And so I'll use the canola oil to do that for me, where I feel like I don't get that necessarily with olive oil because the difference is in cooking temperatures that you're going to need for each, right? And so there are ways you can use those, are the differences in the types of fats and what they're going to do to better support your overall diet program. And when you look at canola oil compared to olive oil on like a fat concentration, like canola oil is going to be like inferior from a monounsaturated fatty acid, but it really kind of just, I guess, replaces it with more PUFAs, right? And so you get a little bit of both doing the canola oil, but if you're really wanting to focus on mono, or MUFAs, then you go with the olive oil. So it's all about whichever one you're being prescribed or you feel best works for you, which you like to taste. Some people may not like the taste because there is a taste to the olive oil that will alter your food a little bit.
Right.
And not everybody likes that, where you could use a different oil that's not going to taste as significant, so to speak. Right. But as we kind of come to, we're getting kind of not to the end, maybe the end, but also like, maybe running out of recommendations, just eat or make sure you control your calories, eat or control your protein and eat good fats.
Yeah. I'll always say this. If you don't know what you're doing, or if you have some other kind of issue that you're trying to monitor along with just overall health, talk to a dietitian. You know, that should be your first contact. Because, you know, me as a humble exercise science individual person, I'm not properly equipped to tell you what
you can't speak to any of this. Don't even look at us.
No, I can't do that.
for sure. Whatever, man. That's how I feel about it. I don't care too much about that. But shoot, I was going to say, as far as recommendations for things like fat loss, though, I've seen, as far if anybody's wanting to track it, like a little bit more religiously or prescribe it, I've seen for weight loss, it would be what, like, it's like 0.5 to 0.6 grams per kg, mm-hmm. I believe. And so if you're trying to lose weight, you should really actually be not consuming that much fat. So if I was an 80 kilogram male, that doesn't leave me, that leaves me with about 40 grams of fat.
Right.
That I'd want to consume. So it kind of just goes to show you, and that's pretty well researched, mm-hmm. as far as like losing weight through sort of dietary fat manipulation. Obviously at a caloric deficit, right? But you're actually removing quite a bit of calories by only doing 40 grams of dietary fat.
Yes.
And so even if you're not trying to control your calories, if you're intentionally reducing fat intake to that degree and not even trying to control calories, you will be at a caloric deficit pretty easily. Right. And so that's one strategy that everybody can have. Like you say, I've used this quite a bit, but in your tool belt, mm-hmm. That's one thing you can have in your tool belt if you're trying to focus on losing some fat.
Just call me Batman. My tool belt is just getting massive over here.
What do you keep in there? How much room do you have in there? That's funny. But yeah, that's typically what I've seen and what I would also recommend for that. Now I can get a little bit hard, and I agree with kind of the flexibility of it as well, as far as, hey, if you need to have a higher fat day, mm-hmm. that's totally okay. It's hard to restrict it to that degree. Just make sure that you're taking away somewhere else that's not protein. So just reduce your carbohydrate intake a little bit, right? So don't overcompensate, right? Just kind of switch up your strategy.
Right. And I think that's a good recommendation, because our ability, inhibitory ability, right? I don't want to say it's a pool that can get drained, because it's not. It can be endless supply of willpower to say no to something, but it's hard, right? And so sometimes it's refreshing and more beneficial than not to have just for ease, I'll call it a cheat meal,
yeah,
like that, you know. Because you know you've hit that reward center of the brain. As long as you're not overstimulating, overdoing it, you know, you just need enough to prime and feed that reward center. And then you're usually good and able to move on from there. There's different ways to do that. You can do it through a cheat meal. You can do it through my choice was like the diet sodas and artificial sweeteners. Those really hit the reward center. You know, they actually, the studies have shown they hit the rewards in the exact same way that a sugary or fat laden meal would. You know,
oh, it's the best. I have one every day when I go home. Instead of a beer at the end of the day, I go home, I crack open a diet Baja Blast.
Yep, exactly. So it's just our brains are really easy to trick. So just finding something like that, and it can take the form of a cheap food item or meal. But it also can just as easily take the form of a diet soda or something else. If you're a sweet tooth person, you know, for somebody that's more maybe satiation focused, that would be triggered by fats. There's other substitutes there that can hit the same center.
Yeah. And I agree. And I think that's the better way to think about it is as we give recommendations and as we say things, mm-hmm. it's always important to say that that's not kind of this or the set in stone thing. Now it depends on the goal, right? Sometimes if you're getting down into the nitty gritty of things like, hey, no, you can't do that, but that's not a forever thing, right? Or that time period or that goal, whatever, will kind of pass and you can kind of reevaluate and you could include some more fat, but again, getting into the details there. I would always say that if you're having a hard time struggling to meet a particular fat intake, because let's say again, most people are already consuming a lot of fat, we're taking away a huge portion of their diet. They're gonna have to restructure a lot of their life and their kind of habitual nature as far as food intake goes. If you need to add some more back in there, I have no problem with that. Let's take away from something else because we still need to be at a caloric deficit. And I'll be the first person to tell you it's not gonna be protein. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there are ways that we can do the flexible dieting, which is a, I would say is probably a decent term to use now. I don't know what else you would call it other than some really advanced term as far as intermittent.
I bet I could find somebody that could tell us for sure, but
intermittent, prolonged, intermittent, prolonged energy dense macronutrient manipulation science.
Sure. Write that down. You coined that.
Yeah. So I would, So like I said, I think you can do it that way. And it's a really usable strategy. And I think it's a beneficial strategy as well. Or to do, and it gives you greater metabolic flexibility.
Right.
Right. To be able to kind of do both strategies kind of over time. Right now, I'm not saying, you know, one way or the other, the seesaw effect, right? But to spend some time in one area, spend some time in the other area, spend some time in the middle, and give yourself some better metabolic flexibility that way, right? Your body is adapting to that, and going one way or the other is not so difficult. Right. Or having to be counterbalanced the other way. And so, but anyways, I think that might be all we got for today.
You know, I think this is it can be a complex topic, but
there's a lot to still go into as far as like, depending on how unfocused you would want the conversation to even be.
Right. And I think this would be there'll be a good direction to take this, into more specific routes once we get the interest. So like always, I've gotten some good feedback from some listeners so far. So you guys keep feeding me ideas. I've got a little bitty notebook, little handy dandy notebook.
There you go.
that when I hear
recommendations. I always forget the name. It's who's the guy in the water boy? The coach with his little notebook. I forget the coach's name. On the water boy, remember he's got his notebook and he gets stolen by the other coach.
I haven't watched that movie in probably a decade.
Okay, fair enough. But you have seen it. That's all that I actually care about.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're the coach from the water boy with their little playbook.
It's a little tiny little notebook here that has all my ideas and recommendations and whatnot in it. From my brain, other people's brains, you know. So keep feeding those in. We've got some cool guests lined up that I'm excited about. I think it'll be really interesting. So y'all won't have to listen to just Austin and I keep jabberjawing forever and ever. We have some interesting people coming on board. So as always, thank you guys for listening. We'll do it again next week. We'll hopefully start ramping up our output a little bit more adept at this. We're getting better, you know, so thank you guys for bearing with us. We're still figuring all this good stuff out.
Yes.
Still a big podcaster, you know.
For sure. So we're going to go carb up with our pizza and get a good training session.
Yeah. Bingo. We'll talk to you guys later. Thanks for listening.